This is Archival Moments on VOCM. For the next hour, we'll explore the great stories and traditions that can be found in the archives of Newfoundland and Labrador. Archival Moments with Larry Doey and Brian O'Connell on VOCM.
And once again, from the rooms in St. John's, I'm Brian O'Connell, our host, as always, Larry Doey, director and archivist here at the rooms. Thanks for hosting again this week.
Thank you for coming back.
Well, this is a big week in aviation history in Newfoundland and Labrador, the 100th anniversary of Alcock and Brown's flight, a successful flight across the Atlantic, and we're going to talk a bit about that. We're going to talk about Amelia Earhart. I know we've talked about her before in Trapassi, but a little bit of a different spin, and we're going to talk about the first airmail.
That's right.
Carried across the ocean.
Which would be 100 years ago this month.
Okay.
The first airmail, transatlantic, arrives over in Europe.
Now, Alcock and Brown, they weren't the only people vying for that 10,000-pound prize money.
No, there were, in fact, four other crews that were here in Newfoundland at the time. So there was the crew of Mackenzie Grieve, and there was an Australian pilot, Hawker and Grieve. That's how we know that crew. The other crew, there were British aviators, and that's the Ryan Hamm, who was a pilot, and Morgan Ryman and Morgan crew. And then there was the famous, of course, the Alcock and Brown crew. So that's John Alcock and Arthur Brown. And then the other one that don't get a lot of attention, and that's the ones we'll focus on for a few minutes, it's the Hanley Page crew.
Yeah.
So that was a fellow Kerr, Mark Kerr and a Major Brackley. So those were the two people working with the Hanley Page Company.
I guess the locals must have been amazed with all these pilots and machines showing up here.
Oh, yes. So if you go to any of the accounts, like diary accounts, journal accounts, people writing letters, newspaper accounts especially, everyone's got their eyes on the skies, because you have these crews that are, they're either up in Lester's Field or down by Kitty Vitty. There's one crew out in Harbour Grace, but they're all up to the same thing. So they're testing their flights, and so now there's flights that are going out in the morning, and they're just checking out their planes for weight, for fuel, for winds, and how it's going to respond to it, for temperatures. And it would have been a really exciting time in St. John's.
Now, we go back to June 11th, 1919, and all eyes in St. John's and Harbour Grace were looking toward the sky.
And that was all about, there was a crew, the Hanley Page plane, and the crew, they were in Harbour Grace. And so, of course, they wanted to test the capacity of their plane. And so what they did, they took a trip out of Harbour Grace and up the Conception Bay coastline, eventually coming in, flying around St. John's. And there's some wonderful reports about it. So
the Daily Star reported the Hanley Page plane made a splendid takeoff on Tuesday afternoon. The wind was westerly, a moderate breeze, and the machine took the air in less than 100 yards, having reached the height of 2,000 feet. She was headed for St. John's across Conception Bay, passing over Belle Island at an altitude of 3,000 feet, and reached St. John's in 25 minutes. The distance from here to St. John's is 25 miles in a direct line.
So that was really interesting, because this is the first time now to get a sense of how much time it will take to cover that particular distance.
Yeah.
And for the first time, Newfoundlanders have seen, wow, isn't that amazing? Because before this, the only way, or one of the few ways of getting out of Harbour Grace into St. John's would be to hop into your boat and come along the coastline, or, to hop on the train. But certainly this was a new mode, and this was pretty fast.
The weather was ideal for flight, the sky being cloudless, the sun shining warmly, and the visibility good. Are you sure they were in Newfoundland?
They were definitely in Newfoundland, and it was June of 1919.
Anyway, the flight was witnessed by the majority of residents in the Conception Bay towns, the Star reported, and the machine was clearly outlined against the horizon and presented a novel sight to the people of the whole coast, both sides of Conception Bay, many of whom saw a plane in flight for the first time, and they were fascinated.
And they were totally fascinated. Yeah. And then what happens, of course, is that they come in over St. John's, and they spend 10 minutes flying over the city. And I have no doubt what they were doing at that point, because there's no the Hanley Page crew knew that on the ground in St. John's at Lester's Field or down by Kittyvitty, there were three other crews. These were the competition. So I've no doubt that they were up there.
A little psychological thing
on the go. And they just really wanted to impress upon these crews that were on the ground that, you know, we've got a pretty superior craft. Yeah. And here, look at us. We're flying around. We can do this, and we're soon going to take off.
The Star reported the callous-handed fishermen farmers watched with intense interest the huge bird-like machine passing gracefully overhead. Women and children left their dwellings, abandoned their work, and made their way to vantage points and watched the flying machine until lost to sight. It seemed as if the crew desired to give the inhabitants of Conception Bay towns an opportunity to see the huge plane on the wing as he traversed a course returning to Harbor Grace best calculated to accomplish this object. Whether this deduction is correct or not, it is construed by many, and doubtless the residents along Conception Bay settlements appreciated the opportunity afforded them to see the biggest plane of its class in the world make its first trial trip this side of the Atlantic.
So it truly would have been something. So all of the residents going right down to Conception Bay, Holyrood, Avondale, you know, just going down that whole coastline, they're all looking to the skies. Many had never seen an aircraft before. Certainly this was, by her standard, by her day, she was larger than all of the others. She was really something terrific to look at, and they were all really quite engaged in it.
The landing was made as gracefully as the ascent, the machine taking the ground at 5:47 p.m., having been an hour and 17 minutes in the air and covering approximately 110 miles, averaging 90 miles an hour.
That's right. And so as they were going, so if you couldn't see this aircraft, of course, you'd be looking up into the sky and you would hear that aircraft because they were only about 5,000 feet above sea level. And that was very satisfying. You know, that was really satisfying to the locals because if they couldn't have a visual, a sighting of it, then they could certainly hear it. They knew that it was in their area.
The papers noted that Rear Admiral Kerr and Major Brackley says were well satisfied with the result of their trial flight, but the reality was quite different.
The reality was quite different. So if you went back to the newspapers, you know, June the 11th to 12th, 1919, and you saw references to this particular flight, these two men and the Hanley Page team, they left the impression that everything is fine and dandy, everything couldn't have worked out any better. Yeah. But the reality was that they had discovered an overheating problem. Now, if you had an engine problem, an overheating problem, of course, what you had to do, because we didn't have the equipment here, they had to create it or bring it in, which would have caused a delay. Yeah. And they certainly didn't want any of the other crews to know that they were delayed because of a mechanical issue, because they just, their fear was that now the other teams would take advantage of their mechanical issue and leave earlier than they were thinking about doing it.
So the papers reported that competition was growing keen, but the dream of Kerr and Brackley to be the first to make the nonstop flight over the Atlantic were dashed because...
They were dashed because on June the 14th, 1919, so just 3 days later, Alcock and Brown, they leave Lester's Field about 1:45 in the afternoon, and 16 hours later, they pitch in Clifton, Connemara, County Galway, Ireland, so making the first transatlantic flight, non-stop transatlantic flight.
So they received the Daily Mail cash prize, and they were knighted.
They were knighted. There was a number of awards that were given over to them. But that cash prize, £10,000 from a newspaper in London, that's equivalent to $1 million today.
Wow. Incredible. What happened to Major Brackley and Rear Admiral Kerr?
So they headed in an opposite direction. So these are the crew for the Hanley Page. There was no point of them now crossing the Atlantic, a nonstop flight across the Atlantic. They decided, well, we'll just go back, head back to New York. And on the way back to New York, unfortunately, they had mechanical issues and their flight actually landed in pitched in Nova Scotia. They eventually did make it back to New York, but it wasn't what they were thinking.
Now, you must have a lot here in the archives about aviation.
We've got a lot in the archives about aviation. We've got a lot of, especially the coolest thing that we have are the photographs. And one of the great things that you can do, like from your home, you can sit down, you can find...
So they're online. The,
you can find the room's website, and you can go in there and, you know, just in the search engine type in Alcock and Brown or Lester's Field or any other phrases, aviation, and a lot of the images, photographs, maps.
You have the mailbag they carry?
And we do have the mailbag, yes. So the mailbag has been here for a number of years now, and so that's going to be another story we're going to talk about a little later in the show.
All right. And you also have a new exhibit opening. I want to just touch on that.
And we have a new exhibit, and that's the exhibit is second to none, because Newfoundland has always been known, like, so through the First World War, all of these pilots are coming here, so the first transatlantic flight. And then Second World War, all of the plant. There was a time, if you were flying, you had to pitch in Gander, Newfoundland, because that's the way the planes were.
The crossroads of the world.
The crossroads of the world.
Yeah.
And so everything came through Gander. And so through that Second World War, then through that period when Gander was at its best, everyone knew where Newfoundland was. We were the crossroads of the world.
And when will this exhibit open?
So that exhibit is opening. It's already open. In fact, there was a soft opening. So, yes, it's already there. And that's aviation history. It doesn't focus simply on Alcock and Brown. Yeah. It also focuses on some other big historic moments in Newfoundland's aviation history.
I don't think people realize how important Newfoundland was to those first flights.
No, a lot of people don't. And there's lots of people on the ground now, especially because they're taking advantage of the 100th anniversary. Aviation Newfoundland and Labrador have brought in a number of speakers. Here at the rooms, we've had a number of speakers talk about our place in aviation history. That's Newfoundland and Labrador's place in aviation history. So it is really quite significant. And you'll get a good sense of that just by seeing the exhibits second to none, which is here at the rooms.
All right. There's so much here at the rooms, and of course, Alcock and Brown, they are a celebration of 100 years, and there's so much for you to see and to seek out here at the rooms. We encourage you to do that. We're not done with flying yet. We're going to talk about the First Lady of Flight, Amelia Earhart, and her arrival in Trapassi. I know we've talked about this before, but we have a few things to add to that this time around. And we'll do that next when Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
This time around, we're going to talk about the First Lady of Flight, Amelia Earhart. I know we've chatted about her before, but we're talking aviation, and we simply can't ignore that. She landed in Trapassi June 14th, 1928.
That's right, which is really quite a significant date, because that is the date, the same date that Alcock and Brown left making the first nonstop transatlantic flight.
Now, she was a passenger on the Friendship 7, a Fokker F7 airplane.
She was indeed. So she was a passenger. It's not... So she celebrated in 1928 because she's the first woman, even though she's a passenger, to cross the Atlantic. It's not until 1932 that she really claims a different, whole different status as the first woman to solo flight across the Atlantic.
And if you're landing in Trapassi in June, there's a very good chance you're going to run into some bad weather.
And that's exactly what happened. So she pitched in with these two crew members, pitched in Trapassi on June the 14th, 1928. And I think it was 16 days then that they were held up in Trapassi because and it was essentially wind and fog, but primarily it was fog.
The newspapers reported the Friendship circled Trapassi twice before putting down in the choppy water of the harbor after a flight of 4 hours, 24 minutes, as the big monoplane taxied slowly toward the small cluster of houses on the eastern shore that was the town of Trapassi. Dories full of men whirling ropes. Amelia Earhart called them maritime cowboys, each evidently hoping to guide them in, surrounded the Friendship.
And I was really interested in that expression, the maritime cowboys, because you can picture it in your mind's eye. Yeah. So they've got ropes and they're trying to tie onto this, this seaplane.
Yeah.
so that they can drag it into the wharf, right? So I did a little research to discover that there was it was the town magistrate, Fred Gill, and his two sons, Burnham and Hubert, who were actually the Maritime Cowboys. These were the first to approach Amelia Earhart and say, welcome to Trepasse. But what was really interesting, because I started to dig a little bit further, so Fred Gill, and I knew that name, that's a Bay Roberts, Harbor Grace, Carbonear area name, and then Burnham Gill. So Burnham Gill I knew. In fact, Burnham Gill, when he grows up, he becomes the provincial archivist for the province of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Well.
And so that was his real claim to fame. So he met Amelia Earhart when he was just he would have been a teenager.
Incredible.
And he did something else as well, because the world was watching Trepasse, and all of the newspapers wanted to get as much as news as possible from out of Trepasse. And there was a reporter down there, and apparently the reporter might have had too much to drink, or he was just tired or whatever. So he asked this young Philip Gill to go to the telegraph office and send news back to the newspaper in New York that Amelia has taken off, that, Amelia is now in the air. So there was actually this fellow, Burnham Gill, as a young teenager, was the first to let the world know that Amelia Earhart, number one, is in Trepasse, and now she's getting ready to leave Trepasse.
That's an incredible story.
Oh, it is, yeah. So
it's, wow. Now, the children of Trepasse were pretty amazed at this, as were the sisters.
Saucy little brats, you know what they did? Here, the plane is flying. Amelia's plane flies over Trepasse, and that crowd down Trepasse didn't wait for the nuns to let them out. They just raced away from the school.
Bolted
down to the waterfront. All were quite shocked. And the nuns, actually, they were not too pleased with this. And so as a consequence, they were all brought back to school, and then they had to wait, for the discipline, that they didn't close the school until later that day. They kept them in. But poor Amelia was down there, and she talking to these kids, and she had no idea what was going on. And so as a form of apology, she went up to the school the second day that she was there just to explain that she hadn't realized that they'd bolted from the school.
And the sisters were scandalized.
Well, the sisters were scandalized because the sisters had never seen a woman before in breeches.
Yeah.
So Amelia stepped off that flight. So, of course, she pitches in Trepasse. She thinks she's only going to be in Trepasse for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And then they're going to get out and start that flight across the Atlantic. And but anyhow, she stepped out, and then the fog came down, and then she's going to be there, I think it was for about 16 days or so. So the whole time she's there, lots of people are just looking at her askance and just thinking, my God, she's wearing breeches. She's wearing men's pants.
She didn't pack a change of clothes, because I guess the plane had to carry very, very few items.
They had to travel very lightly, and the idea was, you're going into Trepasse at the minimum, you're going to be there for the day, but certainly just a few hours they were thinking, and then they were going to get out. But no, she didn't have a change of clothes, so she had to borrow and beg from around the town.
Right.
And the nuns were actually some of the first to come forward, because they were so scandalized.
Yeah.
Having not seen a woman in pants before, so it was really quite jarring.
Now, Fanny Devereaux was somewhat shocked. Who's Fanny Devereaux?
So there was only one shop in Trepasse at the time, and that was Fanny Devereaux ran that particular shop, and their house was next door. And so it ended up that Amelia stayed with the Devereaux. Fanny Devereaux was so shocked that she actually went up to touch Amelia Earhart, to physically touch her and brush her to make sure that she was a woman, because she'd never seen a woman in pants before either.
Tell me about the Devereaux children, because they were pretty impressed with this as well.
Oh, the Devereaux were truly impressed. And one of the children, her name was Theophane Curtis. So Theophane Curtis was adopted into that family. And she, when she became an adult, she became a presentation sister.
Okay.
So she would tell the other sisters, early in her life about having met and known. And she would have gotten to know her fairly well.
Yeah, I guess 16 days
in Trepasse. And So when she joined the convent, she became Sister Theophane Curtis.
Okay.
And she would tell stories about her encounters, her having met and spoken with Amelia Earhart as a young teenager.
When did Earhart finally get out of Trepassey?
They got out of Trepassey. There was, I think it was the 17th. They left Trepassey on the 17th of 1928. And then they went as far as Bury Port in Wales, and it took them 21 hours to get out of town.
And they made it across the big pond and eventually back to New York for a ticker tape parade?
That's right. So she was really, really quite, really celebrated.
Yeah.
The two men actually who did all the work on this, and she admits to it, they did not get the attention.
She did.
She got the attention because it was the first time a woman had traveled and over the Atlantic. And that was really something. Yeah. That was like putting the first woman on the moon. For God, you know, you could compare it to that kind of a thing, given the cultural of today.
She had a certain affinity for Trepassey because she made a prediction that it would one day have an international airport.
And I thought that was really quite amusing that she had said that. But she was really quite keen, and that she was actually following that. We've spoken about the NCs. The Americans who had been in Trepassey years previous.
Yeah.
So she was aware of the potential of Trepassey in terms of air travel. So she did actually suggest that Trepassey would one day be would have an international airport, or all transocean flights would travel through Trepassey.
She said that to the New York Times.
She said it to the New York Times.
Pretty impressive. She said Trepassey ought to be someday a great airport for transoceanic travel. It possesses the finest harbor, perhaps the only harbor adapted naturally for seaplane takeoffs in its part of the world. She also had a line of clothes.
She did, because nowadays when anyone gets a bit of celebrity, all the perfume companies want to hire or wear their dresses or the commercial placement, and so she was just one of those. And she realized too that this is a new industry, and women are going to be very much part of that industry, and they need to be comfortable. So she did start a line of clothes, and that included dresses and but it also included pants that she thought were going to be important in terms of just the comfort in terms of traveling.
We go forward to 1932 and we find Amelia Earhart back in Newfoundland.
So she's back in Newfoundland. It's 4 years later. It's May the 20th, 1932. She's 34 years old. She's very well known now around the world. And what she wants to do is to be the first woman to fly solo, leave Newfoundland and get over to the old world.
She headed in Europe?
The initial plan, she was going to fly to Paris in her single-engine Lockheed. And what she was really doing, she was emulating a flight that had been taken earlier by Charles Lindbergh. So he had done the solo flight 5 years earlier. And in fact, a lot of people actually referred to her as Lindbergh. They looked very much alike when you look at the photographs and stuff. And they were both admirers of each other's accomplishments and work.
How long was the flight, and where did she land?
Well, it wasn't Paris that she had hoped for. So it was 14 hours and 56 minutes. It was almost 15 hours.
That's a long flight.
That's a long flight, but you just think about it. It actually takes about 16 hours for us now to fly over to Ireland.
Yeah. Well, that's true. We got to go to Toronto.
So now you got to go to... But when we had that direct flight...
Not much has changed.
We had that direct flight, like it was 3.5 hours or something. Right. So there's nothing as much changed since 1932, because now we're right back to that 14, 15, 16 hours.
So much for advancements.
That's so much. But anyhow, she did. She landed in... north of Derry in Northern Ireland.
And she was recognized by Congress in the States.
She got all kinds of nods and acknowledgments. She got the Distinguished Flying Cross from Congress. She got the Cross of the Knight of the Legion of Honor from the French government. She got a gold medal from the National Geographic Society that was presented to her by the President of the United States, who was Herbert Hoover at the time. So her fame was really, really quite... something.
Yeah. She was responsible for or influenced many people. Eleanor Roosevelt was a good friend of hers.
Both of them became really good friends. And in fact, Eleanor Roosevelt, at her suggestion, and I guess she would have flown with her, she encouraged her to get her own license. So Roosevelt obtained a student permit. But she really didn't pursue it because it was considered too dangerous for the president's wife to be flying.
Earhart also inspired a generation of female aviators. Tell me about the WASP.
So the WASP are the Women Air Force Service Pilots. So when the Second World War started, all of the men, most of the men, were already tied up. They were desperate for pilots. Yeah. And so what the WASPs basically did, they ferried aircraft from the United States down to Newfoundland, then over to England or France, depending on where they could get in. And there were hundreds of these WASPs, these women, thousands actually of these women that were ferrying these flights. So it would have really been something to be in St. John's World War II. Yeah. And you see all of these women pilots are, they're pitching and they're taking off. Must have been really quite something incredible.
And we lost Amelia Earhart in 1937?
1937, yeah. She and a fellow, Fred Noonan, they wanted to circumnavigate the globe. And they went missing somewhere around Hawaii. Some people think maybe they landed on one of the islands. And this is Second World War, so it's possible that they might have been captured by the Japanese. There's all kinds of speculation, all kinds of rumor and fascination about it. And there's even stories that she actually left here only because of the celebrity. She was sick of the celebrity. So there was actually one theory that she came back to New Jersey, took on a different identity, and eventually then, but that has been proven wrong. But there's all kinds of rumors. It's just like Elvis. Yeah. Like a lot of people still believe that Elvis lives. That was also true of her. She was one of the first big celebrities. Yeah.
Fascination with her life continues.
That's right.
All right. Well, you are Amelia Earhart, her connection to Newfoundland. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the first time mail was carried by air across the Atlantic, and Newfoundland had a hand in that. That when Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
And we continue with our aviation theme this week on Archival Moments on your VOCM. And this time around, the first time mail was carried by air across the ocean. No doubt Newfoundland had a hand in that.
That's right. And so we're right back to aviation history again, and we're right back to Alcock and Brown, and we're right back to June the 14th, 1919, Alcock and Brown. They leave Newfoundland, and they eventually pitch over in Clifton, Ireland, in Connemara, Ireland. But what's important or interesting about it is that they brought a mailbag.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there were about 169 pieces of mail in that mailbag, and on each piece of that mail, there was a stamp. So if you can get your hands...
I was going to ask, did any of those survive?
Well, I heard that within days of that particular flight, one of those envelopes sold for $700. Now, this is 1919.
That's a lot of money.
So you can imagine what it's worth right now. And one of the really important letters that was in that mailbag was actually a letter that Alcock had written to his own parents. And so in the mailbag, he just put a letter with a stamp on it that, that he was going to bring over for his parents.
And he wrote, "This letter I am sending by the first transatlantic air post, which I am going to carry."
And he
very confident.
Very confident. And he did carry it. And what happens, they do depart here on the 14th of June, 1919. And within 16 hours, they're over in Ireland. And he's got that mailbag with him and all those letters. And they eventually get distributed.
Now, tell me about Sir John William Alcock.
So we know him as Alcock and Brown, but it's John William Alcock. And so he was a captain in the Royal Naval Air Force Service and the Royal Air Force during the First World War. Now, unfortunately, he was killed very shortly after this transatlantic flight. He was killed in December. So this flight was in June, and he actually died in another flight just a few months later in December of 1919.
Yeah.
So he really never, I can remember, he's also was now a much richer man.
Yes.
He was sharing £10,000 with his friends. Yeah. So he was quite wealthy when he passed. And then the other guy is Sir Arthur Witten Brown. And so again, he had, in the First World War, it was with the Royal Air Force. Actually, the story goes that he actually walked into the Vickers Limited plant, looking for a job.
Yeah.
And Alcock was there, and Alcock and he started having a conversation about the possibility of taking on this bit to fly out of Newfoundland to...
And that's where that started.
That's where that started.
Incredible.
So within about 20 minutes, they became pretty good friends and then co-pilots.
Wow.
And next thing you know, they're on their way to Newfoundland and making world history.
Now, Brown eventually achieved the rank of lieutenant colonel, and he was served in World War I and in World War II.
That's right.
And so, what about the Vickers Vimy, the aircraft? That was a bomber, right?
That was a bomber,
yeah.
And so, of course, we know that she landed over in Clifton, County Galway, near Connemara. But there was a nosedive. So
yeah.
She was, in fact, somewhat damaged on arrival.
So whatever happened to the plane?
Well, people were really keen on that particular plane because of her significance, and parts of her are in different museums.
Okay.
I can't identify the particular museums,
yeah. But they're in existence.
They're in existence.
Okay.
So here, for instance, at the rooms, our particular piece of interest is the mailbag, right?
So tell me about that.
Well, I knew very little about that mailbag until I got a telephone call from Shirley Birmingham. So Shirley Birmingham is here in St. John's, and she's 95 years old. She phoned me up, and she said she's seen lots of coverage on the Alcock and Brown, but absolutely no reference to the mailbag. And I said, well, tell me your story. And so then she explained to me that it was her grandmother who had created the mailbag. So her grandmother was a seamstress and a tailor here in St. John's. She worked on one of the shops and worked from home as well. And so she was telling me that, and her name is Mary Daly. She was Mary Daly, and she married Captain John Jackman. Well, anyhow, down at the post office, so there was, she married a fellow, John Jackman.
Yeah.
Down at the post office, there was a fellow, Jim Jackman. So Jim Jackman knew that she was quite accomplished as a seamstress. So he approached her and asked her if she would consider making the mailbag. So she said, oh, for sure. And but so she proceeded then to create this mailbag that the mail was put into, that was put on that flight, and it was sent over to Ireland.
Now, the Jackman family also has a connection to the Titanic.
Which is really interesting.
Boy, this is a great family lore.
It's great family lore. And so this is Captain John Jackman. So we've met him before because we had a conversation about the Titanic.
Yeah.
And after that disaster, a number of rescue vessels were sent out to search out for the bodies of the victims of the Titanic. And the Algerine was one of those boats. So the Algerine and the captain is Captain John Jackman.
Okay.
He went out and he found the body of a young fellow McGreevy from Ireland. And the life jacket that we have here was given over to us by the Jackman family, or made its way through the Jackman family, which is quite a significant piece of history. And the mailbag makes its way here through that same line, same family.
And the bag is made of what?
It's the bag is made out of canvas, and so it's a natural canvas. It's a rectangular bag, and written on it says St. John's Newfoundland GPO, printed in large black letters on the front. Now, GPO, we know GPO is the General Post Office, right? And then below, this is printed in the fountain pen ink. It's Vickers Vimy Rolls Aeroplane, Transatlantic Air Post 1919. And the other significant thing about it is that the name John Robinson is actually included on the bag as well. Now, John Robinson was the colonial secretary and the postmaster general, so that's why his name was on the bag.
And it says, please return bag?
And it says simply, please return bag. And I don't know what the route was to get it back here, because you can imagine it was quite a significant piece of history. This is the bag that brings over the first mail.
Yeah.
But eventually it makes its way back.
And her name is written
just on the inside seam of the bag, and it says M. Jackman, so that's Mary Jackman. And there's actually a date, so clearly she must have made this mail bag on this 10th of June, 1919, because that's the date that's written in blue ink on the inside ring.
Incredible. And tell me about the exploits of Alcock and Brown. They were on stamps.
They became, super celebrity status. And so one of the places where they'd be really recognized is in the stamp community. It's because they were the first to bring stamps. So they carried 196 letters and one parcel postmarked between the 10th of and the 13th of June at St. John's. And so when they take that mail bag over now, this mail in 16 hours has totally new, wonderful significance. It's that first flight. And that was one of the reasons why the big money was behind these flights, because people realized this is a great communications tool. This is a way of speeding up. This is a way of the world coming together and much quicker, and clearly getting mail in 16 hours rather than, several days or weeks. It improves communications.
You have a lot of material here for people who want to seek out Alcock and Brown.
There is a great deal of material here on Alcock and Brown. I mentioned already that you can actually go online and see many of the photographs that are relative to it. You can go, and I always suggest to people, go to the newspaper accounts for the day, because those are the pieces that are written nearest to that time frame. And there's so much detail. And, just remember that the people that are on the ground, our photographs from here, for instance, there's so many children that are up on Lester's Field and up there on where it's now Blackmarsh Road that would go up there. Kids would get out of school, they'd go up there, and there's lots of photographs with kids there. There was just such an exciting time. And you can see that. And the other thing I suggest to people is just come to the rooms and see the mailbag. Yeah. See that mailbag that is now 100 years old, that's so important in communications history.
Incredible, incredible stories. And we mark 100 years for Alcock and Brown, and you can do that here at the Rooms. Well, we've got a few things going on at the Rooms this weekend. Along with the aviation attraction, we have some events specific for you and your family, and we'll talk about that next when Archival Moments continues on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
As always, we like to leave you with a little of what's happening here at the Rooms, and there is a lot. So let's jump right in.
And I suppose everyone should know that on June 17th, that's when things really start hopping here, because on June 17th is when we start our summer programming, which basically means there's at least two activities, there's two events that will happen here every day right until the end of September. So we're going to be on steroids. We're going to be really busy. And and we want the people to come and be with us and enjoy this beautiful space.
So on June 17th, you have We Play For You and Fishing For Cod.
That's right. So those are two of the guided tours. So what's going to happen is just about every day, there's going to be two guided tours. Typically, one of those will be at 11 o'clock in the morning and the other will be 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
So We Play For You, that's a music session. So we'll bring in a musician, say it's fiddle, accordion. Yeah. It's typically a traditional instrument. We've even got harp coming in, and they'll be down in the or up in the atrium, that beautiful window looking out on the harbor, and they'll be playing some music for a couple of hours every day.
Now, you have Kim Greeley here on Tuesday.
That's right. So very well-established musician.
And, of course, the First World War exhibit, that award-winning exhibit for the Royal Newfoundland Regiment.
And so we've got a tour arranged for that. And typically these tours are about 30 to 40 minutes. And so if you have not seen the First World War exhibit, this is a great time to get out where you can actually walk through it with one of our guides. And then, just come back and take some more time on it, because you really can't do justice to it in 40 minutes. But you get a good sense of what we were trying to accomplish when when it was built.
What is Classics in Newfoundland, an unexpected presence?
So Classics in Newfoundland, we work with the Department of Classics over at the university.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to do was pull out of our collections references to our classical history. So there was a time when the Athenaeum was here in St. John's.
That was a big theater.
Big theater, 1,000 seating capacity.
Wow.
But they would put on huge productions, and lots of these productions had a classical bent. They'd be out of Roman and Greek mythology.
They would bring in troops from the United States.
They would bring in troops from the United
States. Which was something back in the day.
There was lots of traveling troops, and they were bringing in, you know, very high-end classical performances.
Yeah. Tell me about the Newfoundland Dogs, because they're going to make an appearance here, too.
The Newfoundland Dogs are
they're
here.
That's a big hit with tourists. Eh?
They're here every Saturday. And tourists, you know, they actually come with the expectation. If you Google Newfoundland, the first thing comes up are those Newfoundland Dogs. And so when they come, there's an expectation that they're going to find the Newfoundland Dog. And so our way of trying to rise to that expectation is to have the dogs right on the steps here at the rooms. And, you know, the tourists... Well, even the locals love it.
You
just watch kids. Those dogs are so beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, then everyone's got their cell phone and they're ready to snap a few pictures.
And there's one thing we skipped over, but you do a history of Fort Townsend where the rooms is located.
That's right. So this is a beautiful site. This is a site that goes back to the 1770s, you know, when Fort Townsend...
And it's a commanding site. You can see why they'd want to build a fort here because it overlooks the town.
That's right. And you can see the imprint of it. So part of that tour is then... They will walk you to the different points of, you know, just the outline of the fort, the significance of the fort, the place of the fort, and military history generally.
And we have quite a bit of military history here.
We do, especially in this neighborhood.
Yeah, so there's so much happening here at the rooms, and of course, this is the Father's Day weekend, and we want to extend best wishes to fathers this weekend. You also have an event, if you're listening on Saturday tomorrow, if you're listening on Sunday today, it's an event for Dad?
Just a gentleman's afternoon tea here on Sunday, so what you should do is just sign up for that now and enjoy a lovely menu.
And after you have something to eat, you can take a tour of the rooms.
That's right.
Great Father's Day idea.
Imagine.
Spend that day with Dad. Yeah.
Have a great lunch with Dad and then bring Dad to all the galleries. Here.
Well, as always, sir, it's a real pleasure to speak with you, and we look forward to returning next week for another Archival Moments. Larry Doe is a director and archivist here at the rooms. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Brian O'Connell, and we'll talk again next week on Archival Moments here on your VOCM.
Join us next week as we celebrate the colorful history of Newfoundland and Labrador with Archival Moments on VOCM.